Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
God is somebody who follows you and makes your rights not wrong. Someone who protects you when you're in danger, who sends angels to give you messages.
For most kids who believe in God, the general feeling is that God is benevolent.
I guess someone who's like here to bring peace on earth.
Looking out for them.
Not trying to eat us all.
Definitely not trying to eat us all.
God is often portrayed as somebody who tries to help.
But that benevolence goes both ways. God will be good to you if you're doing what God wants. And according to most, what God wants is for you to be good to others.
Probably to help everyone around us and even help yourself and love yourself.
She just really cares about what we do and how we affect people.
But what about the kids who don't believe?
I don't really know what I believe.
I don't really believe in God.
I'm still kind of like figuring that out.
If kids don't think there's a God urging them to be good and caring and generous, will they still do it? According to recent surveys, 65% of all adults think maybe not. Or put another way, 65% think children need religion to grow into ethical adults. Even nearly half of younger adults, those in their 20s and 30s, the ages at which many are leaving traditional faiths, believe religion is necessary to teach morality to kids. But opinions don't always match reality, and in some ways, that's true here. You see, the relationship between religion and morality isn't a simple one. We all know people who have never been to a church, temple, or mosque, and yet are paragons of virtue. Likewise, we know people who profess a faith, but who we wouldn't trust with our money. Still, when you take a closer look at the data, you find something interesting. Certain spiritual practices, if done regularly, do seem to make a difference. They do seem to bring out our better angels. So what's a secular parent to do? On this episode, we're exploring the formative years of childhood and how to lay the foundation of morality with or without religion. We'll hear more from children who attend services at the Fourth Universalist Society of New York, talk with a psychologist who studies the link between religion and morality in children.
Thinking that God knows the good stuff that you do predicts behaving more generously in this task.
And hear from a Unitarian Universalist minister about how she fosters moral growth in the young people she guides.
Even from a young age, their voices and their take on things and what it means to them in their heart or their spirit is valued.
I'm Dave DiStenno, and this is How God Works. For most of us, regardless of our faith, the concept of God changes as we grow. When you're little, your parents can seem almost all-powerful. But as you get a little older, you realize they're not. But maybe someone else, something else, just might be. And while thinking about God might seem like a complicated topic and hard for kids to understand, Larissa Heifetz, who runs the Social and Moral Cognition Lab at Columbia University, says it's not.
Before I started doing this work, I thought kids would have to be pretty old, like maybe later elementary school, adolescence, to even have any concept of God because it's such a complicated idea. But we've actually found that even really young kids have some kind of sense of who or what God might be. So preschoolers, so like 3-4 years old.
So when those first kind of inklings or views come, what do they think God is? How do they think about him, her, or it? Is it like a friend, like a parent, like something scary or something nice?
So I think the best way to think about what happens across development is that kids might think that God is pretty similar to a person. Really young kids, for instance, will say that God has the same moral beliefs that they themselves do. So they seem to be thinking, you know, other people and God and me, we're all the same Some of the earlier work on religious cognition has said that kids conceptualize God as similar to a parent. And then as they get older, they learn to distinguish one human mind from another. So what we call theory of mind, right? So around the age of 4 or 5, most kids can explicitly tell you other people know information that other people don't know. And so as they develop that capacity to understand that human minds are different from each other, they also develop the capacity to say God's mind is different from any of these other human minds.
God knows everything because he is somebody that is special and you can't see him, so he could probably know everything.
If God knows everything you're doing, that means you're always on the record, so to speak. Imagine how your behavior might change if you knew someone could see you all the time. You might be a little more careful about what you do. And that has played out across human history. When humans lived in small groups, it was hard to be lazy or a cheat. If you didn't help hunt, get food, or otherwise cooperate with your group, people would know it. But as human societies became more complex, cheating became easier. If a scribe fudged some numbers in records, or even now, if you round down a bit too much on your taxes, who's really gonna know? And anytime there's anonymity, research shows bad behavior goes up. So what allowed these more complex societies to grow rather than crumble under corruption? According to the psychologist Ara Nourzian, it's God. Or more accurately, a belief in an omniscient, all-powerful being who values virtue. When Nourzian looked at the historical record, he found that belief in a big God, as such deities are called, grows as societies themselves grow. So even if people thought their family, friends, or bosses wouldn't know they misbehaved, they believed God would. And when God's controlling your ultimate punishments, best God has a good opinion of you. So how do beliefs about God's omniscience work with children? If and when kids come to believe that God will know everything they do, does it change what they do? Does it make them nicer? Larissa had the same question, and even better, an experiment that showed the answer.
We gave kids the opportunity to share stickers with another person. So that was our measure of how generously they behaved to somebody that they didn't know.
I was just remembering back when my kids were young, stickers are a very valuable commodity.
Yes. Yes. Children love stickers.
So how old were these kids?
They were preschoolers, so 4 to 5 year olds, I believe, in that study. And the finding there is that the more kids thought God knew about their own good behaviors, the more stickers they shared with another person. Right, so that was a correlational study. We can't necessarily say that one of those things causes the other thing, but we did find a link between those two factors where it seemed like thinking that God knows the good stuff that you do predicts you behaving more generously in this task.
If you had to quantify the difference, like how big a difference are we talking about?
Probably on average a difference of 1 to 2-ish stickers out of 5. So we give them 5 stickers and they can give as many as they want to another person and the rest of the stickers get thrown out. So they don't even get to keep the other stickers. They're just deciding how many they want to give to another person.
So what does that tell you about the importance of this idea of an omniscient God in fostering kids' pro-social behavior?
I can see how a child might come to the conclusion that if God knows the good things that I'm doing, it's particularly important for me to do good things. It might also be the case that if in that study we asked them if their mom knew when they were doing pro-social behaviors, that might be another avenue towards getting that same result. I think God is special in the sense that we have these stories that God knows what you're doing all the time. God doesn't have to be, you know, physically in the same room as you, whereas how kids think about their parents might be more limited. But I think it's generally this idea that somebody knows what I'm doing and therefore it's important for me to do the things that they might want me to do.
And a lot of kids do think God wants people to be good.
I think if he could give me one thing to do, I think it'd be to help people with things, you know, be helpful.
Something that would help the greater good, like
cleaning up and helping the environment.
Do chores.
So if God wants you to be good, what happens when you're not? Do kids think people should be punished? I put that question to Larissa.
It's a great question. So we've done a lot of work on punishment using the legal system as an example. And in that context, we found that kids were largely attributing incarceration to internal badness. So in general, they think that people tend to be pretty good. But if we say, look, here's a person who went to prison, why did that happen? They tell us things like, oh, that person must have been a bad person. At the same time, kids also think that punishment is redemptive. So when they learn about someone who has received this severe form of punishment, they think that person is a bad person, but the punishment is going to make them better. So it's kind of an optimistic view about what punishment might do.
And then is there any evidence that kids are more willing to punish one another because of that or to expect punishment for their transgressions?
So there is some work that kids will dole out punishment, even in a third-party context. So if they themselves are not harmed, but they observe someone else being harmed, they will punish the transgressor. They will evaluate somebody more favorably if they punish the transgressor rather than if they do nothing. So punishment seems to be a really important aspect of children's moral cognition.
In some ways, the issue of punishment brings up an even bigger question about human nature. Do kids think people are inherently good or bad? Kids endorsing punishment could suggest the latter, that they think people need to worry about consequences to get them to restrain their less than moral impulses.
It makes me think of some work on perceptions around the good true self, right? So the theory of human nature going on there is that people in general want to do things that might not be the ideal moral thing to do, and they have to restrain themselves from doing the bad thing. Whereas I think intuitively, a lot of people might think people are actually really good inside. They actually are driven to do good things and want to do good things. If we think about how kids are with their parents, they're not always doing things because they're worried their parents are going to punish them. They also do things because they love their parents and they want to do the things that their parents want them to do.
This morning when we came back from 7-Eleven, I held the door for Maba. I really love my family. One time I made a bracelet for my friend Emma Rose at school, and I did it because she asked me, and her mother was getting a COVID shot tomorrow, so I just wanted to make up her day.
It seems we can do the right thing for two reasons. We can do it because we think God, our parents, our teachers, whoever's ultimate judgment we care about, will be upset if we don't. Or we can do it because we think God, our parents, our teachers will be happy if we do. We want to do things that make them proud of us, and in doing so, make us proud of ourselves. That may sound like two sides of the same coin, but it's really not. If kids are only behaving morally because they're worried they'll be in trouble if they don't, it means they're always focused on trying to overcome their less than admirable impulses. And if they ever feel they can get away with something, like when you remove the belief that God is always watching, that worry can go away and their ethics can take a hit. But if they're behaving morally because they think it's important and it makes them feel good, morality can become its own reward. To work, the first route requires believing in an omniscient deity. Someone needs to be watching and judging all the time. But the second doesn't. While kids can want to be fair, generous, and kind because they love God and want to be like him, her, or it, they can also develop a moral sense based on these feelings in other ways, too. Hi, How God Works listeners. I wanted to let you know that we're on Instagram now. Look for us at How God Works Pod to keep up with happenings, get episode previews and bonus info, and even some looks behind the scenes. Also, we want to hear what you're thinking and how you like the show. So leave some review comments or stars where you listen. We'd appreciate it. Now, back to the show. Unitarian Universalism, like many religions, places an emphasis on morality. But unlike most other religions, it welcomes all perspectives, even secular ones. Leonissa Ardizzone is a minister at New York City's Fourth Universalist Society. Before that, she worked as a scientist and a science educator. She's also a jazz musician. What can't she do? Anyway, I asked her whether she thought children need religion to grow into moral adults.
That is an excellent question, and it's one I've
not gone, to put you on the spot.
It's perfect. Let's start out with swinging here. My gut says no, because I do think that we can raise moral children without a sense of organized religion. But my companion answer is that there needs to be some kind of active learning about a sense of interconnectedness, empathy, morality, right? So there has to be other ways for us to ensure that our children get that. I think that's the challenge. I think schooling doesn't necessarily do it, certainly the way it's done now. And I think for busy families who are like wrapped up in the world and worries and consumerism, it's hard to think that where else will my kids get this stuff? Where else do I learn and or help them understand what it means to be part of a moral, ethical, and, you know, spiritual connection to the world, right?
I mean, one of the things about Unitarian Universalism is that it is more encompassing, right? You welcome people from many different past faiths with many different views of God, even an atheistic humanism among some of them. And so I'm wondering, in your experience with providing religious education, especially around, you know, growing into being a moral person, what does Unitarian Universalism base that on? Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. I actually want to start by saying that I became a UU, I keep trying to remember, 15, 16 years ago. And one of the main reasons was is that I had been a religious spiritual seeker. And when I had a child, I was part of a Buddhist sangha, but it wasn't necessarily a thing you could bring a baby or a toddler to. And so I had the impulse of wanting my child to be raised in religious community. And I shopped around, and it was the UUs, whom I had known from years before and admired their way of thinking. But when I really dug in and went, okay, this is also about my kid, this is not just for me, I knew I had found our spiritual home for my daughter and I. And part of the reason why, it was largely about a helping young people, even if they're four, understand the plurality of belief, the what's out in the world, what it means to be kind and decent and aware and loving, and you finding that path, even when you're four or you're 13 or you're 20, right, along that way, and or an adult, right? We view, in Unitarian Universalism, we view religious education, or we often call it religious exploration, as a lifespan endeavor, right? We like to keep learning and growing because our faith, in essence, calls us to that, because we don't have a creed. We don't have a set standard of what you're to believe, but we do have these seven principles, and there's an eighth being added, that they're invitations to how to engage with other people and other ideologies and how to forge a path of belief that feels true to you but does no harm to others. The misunderstanding of Unitarian Universalism is that you can believe anything you want. Like, that is not true, right? Like, you can be open to beliefs, but you don't get to just, you know, you don't get to be a jerk. You don't get to believe whatever you want, right? We have principles and sources, and we invite you to learn about them and to grow into them and critically engage with them. And we do the same thing with children, right? We don't say, here are the rules, kiddos. We're more like, here are the seven principles, and we publish them in child-friendly language with images. So like the first principle, I think, is really like everyone matters, or sometimes, or everyone deserves love. You know, and the seventh, we care for the planet and everyone that lives on it, you know, every living thing. And we engage them into discussion of what those mean to them.
If you're a child and if you're learning what's important and how to be a good person, how to have empathy, how to be moral, et cetera, in the world, there's two ways to kind of think about how and why you should do that. There's a way of acting out of guilt. Oh my goodness, I better be good and not steal the cookie or not, you know, hit my brother or whatever it might be, because God's going to know and be mad at me. Versus embracing these virtues because they're things that your parents and God and people you care and love about think are good. And so you want to embrace them as well. And so I'm wondering, when you teach ethics in UU, I'm guessing it's more toward the second than the first way.
Absolutely. And I would even say, as you were saying that, I'm like, I wonder, it's going to sound very Buddhist, but I wonder if there's a third way or a middle way of sorts. I think it's more about, we're a covenantal religion, which means when we join a UU community, we covenant and affirm to be in relationship with one another, which is implied that we won't harm or do things that are counter to this covenant. So the scary God piece, which is what I was raised with when I actively did not want to raise my own child and don't think that actually served me very well in the long run. And then the more second part, like the higher power or the sense of a greater good or a collective consciousness that we all want to be a part of, I think is closer. But I think the offshoot, or maybe it's a parallel or a branch of that, is in Unitarian Universalism, is this sense of a covenantal community where we do these things because we know that's how everyone gets valued. We know that's how we are working towards the world we want to see. So it's not even acting in a moral sense because it's right or wrong, but it's because that's what allows other people to live well as well.
And those two latter ways are important, because the first way, with the angry God or the moralistic God who looks down at you, what that tends to do is make feelings of potentially guilt and shame when you fail. And let's face it, we all fail at times live up as to our moral principles. But it also means that you have the sense of you're doing it not because you want to or because you have a covenant and endorse it and think you're right. Whereas when you're trying to emulate good behavior that other people that you care about reinforce, and then when you embrace it yourself, it becomes something that you yourself stand for.
Absolutely, because it becomes like an embodied living, right? Because I think you're right. I think the shame, guilt part can have a very scary flip side. That's called religious trauma for many people later in life. And UUs do a wonderful job of allowing children to express how this shows up for them. Like on any given Sunday in a worship service, we always have a section that's distinctly for children, and children get to share what that story meant to them or what that reading meant and what they think about, or we ask them a question. So even from a young age, their voices and their take on things and what it means to them in their heart or their spirit is valued.
Even though there are those who may argue, oh, God mistreats us and like God's not helping us, I think that it's not that God isn't helping us. It's more that he's trying to teach us a lesson in which we need to learn. He's trying to take care of us, but he's being a little strict about it.
What God cares most about is probably helping others. Helping people when they're having a hard time, basically. She just really cares about what we do and how we affect people.
I think a lot of parents, me included, my kids are older now, of course, though, but at that time, would want to help my children embrace those principles as they grow. But how do you do that when they're 5 and when they're 7?
Yeah. I don't think we give children credit enough for being able to understand more complex ideas than we think, right? You know, and maybe it's all my years of education and having pretty amazing conversations with young children where I'm like, well, that was quite profound and you're 7, right? Like I've had conversations with adults that weren't as profound as some of the children I've interacted with, right? You know, so we reduce it to ideas. Then we explore them often separately. So there'll be activities. I am a big fan of picture books, right? So I know my colleagues and I love to use stories or amazing figures in history or current figures that seem to embody one of these principles. So we can tell or teach the principle through a story or a person who models or exemplifies that principle.
Listening to or reading stories about noble people, whether from scripture, historical accounts, or even popular young adult novels, can be inspiring, according to kids.
Like in Percy Jackson, the whole series is about him trying to fight like evil monsters and gods and stuff, and bad gods. And then and Magnus Chase is also like Percy Jackson, except it's Norse mythology. So I like how they persevere and they always try to like complete everything, and they're always working hard and they're always trying to set things right, make sure everyone is safe and stuff.
But stories like these work on a deeper level too. They make us feel elevation. That's the term we psychologists use to refer to that feeling people get when they see or hear about someone committing a noble act. Think Mother Teresa taking care of the sick and dying, or John Lewis leading marches against racism in Selma, Alabama. That emotion of elevation does more than just give us warm feelings in our chests. It activates us, moves us to moral action ourselves. And so helping children feel elevation more can help nudge them toward virtue. It's a way to build character. But it's not the only emotional tool. There's another, more elusive, but nonetheless incredibly powerful one: awe.
The awe and wonder piece, I think, is wonderful, especially in religious education for children, because they sort of are born with that, right? Like, they're the natural explorers. They're the ones who look up and check things out or stop and might stare at a line of ants for who knows how long or whatever. And what it does, though, that awe, I think, reminds us, and maybe I'm just speaking for me, but I don't think I am, of we are connected. We are just connected. And we're connected to something far bigger, greater, more amazing than ourselves. So awe and wonder for me is like, you know, we gotta start there maybe. And then that becomes the driving force for anyone, but especially children, to say, I'm curious about why that person like thinks that way. Or I want to know what's happening inside me and what can I learn more about.
When people experience awe, it makes them feel more connected to others and makes them more virtuous. Feeling gratitude works the same way. Let me give you an example. In my lab, we've run studies where people can win much more money if they get heads on a private virtual coin flip than if they get tails. What they don't know is that the coin is fixed. It's virtual, so we can make sure it always comes up tails. Because people think they're doing the flipping in private, meaning we can't see what they flipped, about 53% of them cheat on average. They lie and tell us that they got heads so they can get more money. But if we first have them spend a few minutes thinking about something that makes them feel grateful, we cut cheating in half. The rate goes down to 27%. For many kids, prayer is a way to evoke gratitude. Research shows that children as young as 4 feel gratitude when they pray. But as our work shows, to get the benefits, it doesn't matter to whom people feel grateful. It can be God, but it can also be parents, friends, or teachers. Now, of course, someone might say, why do I need prayer or religion for this? I'll just get some friends together to talk about gratitude to make myself a better person. It'll work the same way, right? What's special about the spiritual side of all this?
I believe it shows up in our practice as ritual. So we start every service with lighting a chalice, right? Like we light a candle to say, this is a sacred time. This is a special space, a time apart from time, if you will, or a spiritual boundary of sorts. And we do that with children. So when they leave the main worship space and then go into their religious education classrooms, we light a chalice, and sometimes it's a real candle, sometimes it's a water chalice. We also have a ritual practice called joys and sorrows that we do with children. They will drop stones into a bowl of water, and they hold the stone, and they use the stone as a representation of a joy or a sorrow they're carrying, so they know that they're passing it into something else. We sing hymns. I know people are surprised to hear that. We have a hymnal. It has been largely scrubbed of, you know, God and Lord language, but nonetheless, we use music as our connection to the spiritual.
So for a parent who may be in that space, which is not comfortable with their traditional faith or have left it, but looking for that sense of connection and wanting to help raise a child to appreciate that and be a member of the society in good standing, who wants to also have that connection with others to basically be a good person, but isn't quite ready to join a UU church yet.
Right.
Do you have any advice for things to do with your child to help them develop that sense of morality and empathy and caring?
I would encourage parents to do some research on children's books that have profound themes. There are so many wonderful stories that are told through words and through pictures. And don't just read them passively. Like, have conversations with your children. Ask them what the images are doing for them, or what do they think of, or how does that make them feel? The second, engage your children in things that are maybe unknown to you, but will allow them to see other ways of life, ways of thinking, ways of worshiping, ways of being. Like, maybe it's a book or a story or a YouTube or music from another culture or another religious spiritual perspective that allows kids to see, like, oh, people who don't necessarily look or live like me also live these moral, impactful, valuable lives, right? And the companion to that is to engage them deeply in a connection to nature, like deeply connect with all living things and interact with them, right? And understand, right? That's the awe, wonder, and the connection. And I guess the final thought I had is about music too. I really think music is a wonderful spiritual pathway that opens us up and has many teachings in it. But I guess ultimately, after saying all that, is that allow your children to have their own opinions. Like, allow them to be curious about what they're curious about and talk about their feelings and talk about things they see that feel unjust or wrong, and don't back down from that conversation. I know many, all right, as parents, we get a little like, oh, what do I do with that, right? Like, if your kid asks why someone is sleeping on the street, have a conversation about that. Or when we watch images on TV of the planet being harmed, right? Engage.
There isn't necessarily a really big journey. A lot of it is just in your everyday life, recognizing when you can help and then doing your best to enact upon that.
And if something goes wrong, that's fine. That's a lesson to learn.
It takes to practice and practice and practice being kind and kind and kind every day until you get it right.
The relationship between religion and morality is complex. Simply identifying with a faith doesn't make people more moral than others who are atheists. But people who are actively involved in their faith do seem to have an edge when it comes to being good. They tend to be more generous, fair, and caring. What this suggests to me is that when it comes to teaching your kids morality, the benefits religions offer might not only come from a belief in God, but from the ways that spiritual practices impact our feelings. Awe, elevation, and gratitude can push us toward virtue. Religions make good use of these tools, evoking them through prayer, stories, and images. But that's not the only way to cultivate them. Remember, you can be grateful to anyone, not just God. You can be inspired by stories of civil rights leaders and environmental activists, not just saints or patriarchs. You can feel awe from nature's beauty, not just sacred spaces. It's less about the who or the what, and more about the how often. That's part of the brilliance of religion. Rituals make that regularity happen. But whether or not kids believe in a beneficent deity, the bigger factor is, as Leonissa says, engagement. Take part in practices that teach and encourage morality. Socio-emotional learning isn't just a buzzword schools use for academic success. It's a tool religions have used for millennia to help people develop character. So make time for awe, elevation, and gratitude in your children's lives, whatever form it takes. Read to them, talk with them, Let them get involved with people and causes that inspire them. You will see an enduring change for the better, one that will help them leave a positive mark on this world. Next time. Being a teen is one of the trickiest times of life. Hormones are raging, social pressures are mounting, and expectations of parents, teachers, and pretty much everyone are growing. So what's a teenager and their parents to do? From bar and bat mitzvahs to bullet dance ceremonies, we'll explore how spiritual traditions help the adolescent brain adult and why it might be particularly tricky in the modern world. How God Works is hosted and written by me, Dave DeSteno. Our senior producer is Josie Holtzman of Future Projects. Associate producer is Sophie Eisenberg. Our executive producer is Genevieve Sponsler. Music and post-production mix and master by Merritt Jacob. The executive producer of PRX Productions is Jocelyn Gonzalez. This podcast was also made possible with support from the John Templeton Foundation.